want to check back in with the debt ceiling negotiations, or lack of negotiations at this point. According to reports, President Obama abruptly ended yesterday's negotiating session, walked out saying enough is enough. And that comes at the same time that we get this message from Moody's rating agency that Moody's has moved a step closer to downgrading the U.S. credit rating because they say there is fear that a deal will not get accomplished. And remember, for nearly 100 years, the United States has had the highest rating possible. We're joined now by Louise Story, Wall Street and a finance reporter for our partner, The New York Times, and Todd Zwillick, our Washington correspondent. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Louise, let's talk about this Moody's rating and how serious we should be taking this. Is this Moody's, again, trying to pressure politicians that people have said they have in the past? Or is this actually Moody's thinking that we're going to default on August 2nd?
You know, there is a real chance that the ratings agencies, Moody's and S&P, downgrade the U.S. Frankly, they may do it even if the U.S. keeps paying their bondholders. What's interesting is that Standard & Poor's has told politicians in the last day in Washington that even if the U.S. keeps making its interest payments to noteholders, if the U.S. misses other payments, for instance, if the U.S. decides to stop paying its vendors or to stop paying some of its retirees or Social Security claims just to avoid not missing the debt payments, they still may consider the U.S. in default and downgrade it. That's what they've done, you know, in Greece and Portugal. Greece and Portugal have continued to pay their bondholders, but they got downgraded anyways because they stopped paying some of their other creditors and some of their own citizens.
Which, again, makes it more difficult and more expensive for the United States to borrow money, to refinance its debts, which is probably going to add to the problems with our debt ceiling and negotiations for the future and our deficit.
Well, absolutely. It's a downward spiral. Think of it this way. Economists would tell you that just raising the borrowing cost in the United States by about 1% will add $80 billion to what the U.S. has to pay out the door to bondholders. So, I mean, that's like the budget of the Department of Energy and the Department of Education combined. So it's really, you know, it's just like when you miss a credit card payment and your interest rates go up. If that happens to the U.S., we're talking very big money.
All right, let's move on to Todd Zwillick here really quickly. Todd, for a long time, Obama has been sort of the optimistic voice, at least to the press, saying, look, no, I'm holding out hope. I think we're going to get a deal. I think we're going to get it done in a week. I think we're going to get it done in 2 weeks. Now it appears that he walked out in frustration last night.
Yes, but his walking out of the room appears to have been just sort of a momentary frustration, not a walking out of talks, you know, in terms of like, I'm walking out of these talks and the talks are over. According to reports, actually many of these reports coming from Eric Cantor, the Republican majority leader himself, when he returned to Capitol Hill yesterday evening after talks at the White House with the president, that they're of course bogged down on a lot of issues, that it's sort of towards the end of the meeting, things kind of reached ahead, and that the president became frustrated with Eric Cantor, said, Eric, don't call my bluff. I will take this to the American people. And then kind of walked out of the room. Now, Celeste, Republicans and Democrats don't even agree on this version of events, because Democratic sources inside the room say, yes, the president did say that. However, he was giving his end of the meeting summation. The meeting was over. Eric Cantor interrupted him two or three times, saying over and over that the president should go for a short-term debt limit increase since they can't get a larger deal right now. President has already said he would never sign such a thing because he wants something to get us through the election in 2012. That Eric Cantor interrupted him several times. Yeah. The president kind of lost his temper and then said, you know, don't call my bluff, Eric, and then said, see you guys tomorrow. Kind of a temper loss, but not like we're not raising the debt limit here.
Okay, but Todd, there are still these complaints emerging, even from members of the Republican Party, that there's a problem with message, that the Republican Party is not united, that there's fighting even among them, that John Boehner should have emerged as really the voice, the messenger of the Republican Party. He hasn't. We also have messages coming from Mitch McConnell in the Senate. We've got Eric Cantor. And I read that Eric Cantor described his relationship with John Boehner as a bit of a soap opera.
And even jokes around Capitol Hill all week that you know, Eric Cantor is the de facto speaker, that John Boehner holds the scepter but not the authority. Those are just jokes now, you know, among staff and stuff like that, which happens at a time like this. It is true there is frustration with what is perceived as a lack of a coherent voice among Republicans because of the different factions that they represent. It has always been a difficult bridge for John Boehner to tie together, representing the entire Republican Party, particularly with the Tea Party. We've talked about that. Eric Cantor has positioned himself as the voice of conservatives and the Tea Party, which number close to 100, probably more, maybe 130 when you count all the self-identified conservatives in the House. Eric Cantor is their voice. Eric Cantor puts pressure on John Boehner. And this, the debt limit, spending, and entitlements, is their number one issue. This is really why they're here. This is why they're here, and it is causing a lot of friction. The president himself reportedly saying to both Boehner and Cantor, which one of you guys am I dealing with? When I have a negotiation with John Boehner, then Eric, you come back and blow everything up. That's fine, but I don't know which one of you I'm negotiating with, so help me out. There is frustration with that.
That's Todd Zwillick, our Washington correspondent. Louise Story is still with us, a Wall Street and finance reporter for the New York Times. You know, another thing that I think, Louise, people are getting confused about is that there are so many reports of people saying, yes, August 2nd is a doomsday date. Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke says that. And then you have other people in reports, like Michelle Bachmann, who's running for president, says the nation will be able to glide past August 2nd. All that Congress needs to do is pass legislation to prioritize payments. So which is it? I mean, help me clear this up for our listeners. Is August 2nd the do-or-die date, or is it not?
Well, I think Standard & Poor's made it very clear in this private meeting yesterday when they said, it's not just about continuing to make the payments to your bondholders. You got to pay all your creditors, because the statements, you know, made by other, you know, people like Bachmann, that you could pass legislation to reshuffle your payments, the S&P is saying that's not going to work. If you don't pay your creditors, we may also downgrade you. S&P would not tell the political leaders which creditors would trigger a downgrade, you know, whether it's vendors or whether it's paying Social Security.
Or any of them.
So it's not going to be so easy just to pass payments around.
Okay, we don't have a lot of time here, Louise, but it sounds like you're saying, yes, August 2nd is the date. That's it.
That's what S&P seemed to say yesterday. I'll be watching the markets very carefully today to see what treasuries do. You know, investors have really been shrugging off a lot of this debate in Washington recently.
If Moody's downgrades, that's a serious business. Louise Story, Wall Street and finance reporter for our partner, the New York Times, and Todd Zwillick, our Washington correspondent.